which is dead. The Castor Cafe's outdoor menu board, festooned with dead weeds, proclaimed Dan White is dead and suicide next to an announcement advertising a reduced price for beer. The manager of the restaurant called White's death a good thing, saying a lot of people were happy about it. Other reactions were less positive. One woman spoke of how sorry she was for White's survivors. She felt the whole issue should be forgotten. Another woman said White's suicide was very sad, adding, "The poor man, imagine what he must have gone through." Still other people claimed to be indifferent, saying they weren't surprised, but didn't really care. Some hadn't even heard. Gay community leaders have been generally subdued in their comments. So far, there have been no public speeches, no rallies. Newspapers are making the most of the story, each day bringing more tortured details. The papers are not so much published as they are carried out screaming into the streets. Headlines foam, Dan White's Year of Fear, and White's Torment Before the Suicide, and Dan White, No Escape for an Outcast. But some believe that last headline is wrong. There was one escape, and White took it. In San Francisco, life goes on. Reporting for Fruit Punch, this is Stephen Scher.
And this is John Sugar. This is KPFA's Fruit Punch, a gay radio show that's heard every Wednesday night at 10 p.m. right here on KPFA 94 FM in Berkeley, KFCF 88.1 FM in Fresno, and 91 in Monterio. The comments I've heard expressed regarding Dan White have been those of compassion for his surviving family. Tonight, I also want to speak of compassion. Compassion for Harvey Milk's family. His family of gay men who, because of him, saw a gay man become a powerful force in their city government. Harvey Milk was a man of truth, justice, and integrity. I dedicate this show to you, gay and bisexual people, who have the guts to live openly and to live honest lives.
One moment, please, until we repair the tape machine.
When your icebox is bare, beat the ribs. Show your stomach you care. Beat the ribs. Hold the rich ass on the power. I think it's a shame. It's really not the problem, but we know who's to blame. And I'm tired of being manipulated. Best of the game.
There's little left to be said that hasn't been said about the suicide of Dan White. I don't think his suicide was an act of cowardice or an act of bravery. It just shows to me that his life went in a direction that made his problems too much to bear any longer. If only he'd done it before he killed two other men. What I resent is the way we all put Dan White in the center of the picture. We make the murderer more important than the victims. Harvey Milk and George Moscone thus become minor characters in their own tragedies. No wonder so many murderers exist in our society. It's the easiest way I know to get people to notice you. Now we're even entering the phase when we're supposed to feel sorry for Dan White. Oh yes, Dan White will be missed. Yes, he will. Because he provided a focus for an understanding of the homophobia, his and other people's, that allowed him to kill two men and get away with it, with only a very lenient prison sentence. Men who have sex with adolescents get a far longer prison sentence. The attitude that he represented, the all-American baseball fireman, fag-hating cop mentality, continues to prevail. But Dan White was a living symbol of the failure of those attitudes, or at least their irrelevance to living a civilized and humane life. Now, unfortunately, people can put out of their minds those uncomfortable feelings Dan White forced them to consider in a negative way and get on with the business of the macho, sports or everything, gay-bashing sentiments that characterize the so-called real men and sometimes even the real women. Rest in peace, No. I hope Dan White doesn't rest in peace, because his type does not give me any peace. I'm Daniel Curzon.
The confession of Dan White. The confession of...
Muffin.
That's the 26-minute taped confession of former supervisor Dan White. We are airing this dramatic recording because it was probably the key to the manslaughter verdict that the jury ultimately returned. Here is the voice of Dan White an hour after the shootings as he gave his account of what happened to Police Inspector Frank Falzone.
You have the right to talk to a lawyer and have him present with you while you're being questioned. Or, if you cannot afford to hire a lawyer, one will be appointed to represent you before any questions if you wish one. Do you understand each of these rights I've explained to you?
I do.
What happens if bang goes off? And that is that I hope the people who are angry and mad and frustrated take their anger and madness and frustration out in a positive way rather than a negative way. And I would like to see every doctor come out who is gay, and every gay dentist and every gay teacher and every gay judge and every gay lawyer and every gay architect come out and rip off the shreds of the closet door and come out forward strongly. It's needed. It will be needed more so then. And if a bullet should enter my brain, let that bullet destroy every closet door.
I mean, there's a doctrine of the law called res ipsa loquitur, right? Which means the thing speaks for itself. Of course the deal was made, because what happened? Those subpoenas were dropped. The parade of San Francisco politicians were never called to establish the moral and social and political climate of the town and the changes in it. The very thing that Schmidt said he would rest his defense on, which was the changes in San Francisco. I mean, they were in code, they were there through all the trial, you know. For this you could read gay, for this you could read black or liberal or pinko, you know. It was clear, you know, where Dan White's all-American 100% character was supposed to go against. Moscone and Melk came out like the bad guys. They were the dirty liberals doing things, you know. To that extent, that little bit of it came out in the trial from the defense's standpoint. But Schmidt's threat was never carried out. The things were dropped. And what was done in the trial was that the defense ran the show. All the prosecution did in the trial was to spend his time proving the facts that Dan White had already confessed to, that he shot him. That's all it did. It didn't do anything else. It did nothing else. So the whole trial was left to the defense. And they ran it on Dan White's good character, and that he just unfortunately snapped. And the jury was given no other possible explanation, no political background, not Dan White's homophobia, not his concern, well stated, and the Police Officers Association, which he represented on the board, not their, you know, distrust and hatred of gays, their hatreds of liberals, their fear that the whole town had been given away by a coalition of, finally, of George Moscone and Harvey Milk, although Moscone all along, up until the time after Harvey got on the board, opposed him politically for other reasons. But this was the final threat. The town was going, as these people saw it, down the tubes to the gays, to the blacks, to the liberal coalition that were doing them, and they were going to be finished. Now, that's motive for anybody in terms of a political assassination, you know? And, you know, Dan White was on record about all those things, and they would never give them to the jury. Now, what did the prosecution get in return for? First of all, they did nothing illegal, you know, in that sense of a fix. It's just like a white lie, the classic lies Jesuits talk about. You just don't have to tell all the truth, right? What you tell is true. You just don't tell the whole story.
And a key part of the Dan White trial that hasn't been examined too closely in the past is the jury. The jurors in the Dan White trial in some ways are the invisible cast of the trial. They are largely anonymous. They have unlisted phone numbers. Ellen O'Leary is an associate producer of KQED Channel 9 in San Francisco. She's been working on a program called The People vs. Dan White. In the course of her work, she interviewed many of the jurors in the Dan White trial.
they don't want to talk about it. They want it to go away. But as soon as they do start talking about it, you realize that it's still very present and it's still very, very painful experience for them. They feel that they did their civic duty, and yet the whole city of San Francisco is mad at them. So many of them say, why do they blame us? Why don't they blame the law? Because they actually ended up feeling that the law fell short, that the whole legal process basically caved in on this one.
What did they give as the reason for coming up with a voluntary manslaughter verdict?
The main thing they say is that they did not have the evidence, that they had these little notebooks that they wrote everything down in, but that they found often that they did not have the evidence to go for a stronger sentence. That when they first went in the jury room, almost half of them were ready to go for second-degree murder and one person for first-degree murder. But that when those who were pushing for manslaughter would say, well, give us the evidence, they found that they didn't have it, that the judge had given them a very strict warning inside the diminished capacity law that they must have hard evidence, or if there's any doubt, they must go on the side of the defendant. And the defense attorney, Doug Schmidt, was so good, he raised a doubt at every single juncture. He raised a doubt about why White climbed in the window of City Hall rather than going through the front door. He raised a doubt about why he walked across the hall to talk to Harvey Milk. You know, he said he saw one of Milk's aides, and it occurred to him that why don't I go chat with Harvey after he just killed the mayor, and they actually fell for it. Many fell for the psychiatric testimony, though they say it all sounded the same, that the prosecution didn't have anything, that it just all fell together in a mumbo-jumbo of doubt. Also, they took the cases one by one, which was just a decision of theirs. It was just the dynamic of in the jury room. They went first all the way through Moscone, and they got to this point where four of them still wanted to hold out for second degree, but then they didn't have the evidence and they gave in. And then they went and did the whole Milk thing like a repeat, instead of looking at it as a whole crime where they would have maybe at least gone for premeditation on Milk. They did it like a duplicate process, got to the same juncture where they were deadlocked, and then the four gave in again.
Gays were systematically weeded out of that jury. The system does not respond to us. It still considers us second-class citizens. If a black person shot a white person, they wouldn't go out and systematically exclude all blacks from it. Or if a white person shot a black person, they wouldn't go and systematically exclude all whites from it. We were systematically excluded from that. The question was asked, have you ever joined an organization had anything to do with gay rights? And the people were dismissed from the jury immediately if they said they did. That's wrong. It's criminal. It's the attitude of the city towards us. Mayor Feinstein, the leadership in this city has got to come to this community, and they've got to talk to us, they've got to open up dialogue, or else it's going to be a very, very long, hot summer.
Councilor Munch, got the point, I couldn't take it. And I never wanted a job for ego or, you know, perpetuate myself or anything like that. I was just trying to do a good job for the city.
Our community has been very quiet during the Dan White trial, but there's no doubt we're very tired of hearing outpourings of sympathy for this pathetic man and hearing him portrayed as a victim, as a nice guy who ate too many candy bars. And certainly as we get toward the jury time, we are building anger toward Dan White.
There was no instruction from the judge as to how they should consider the cases. This was just purely up to them to decide.
No, the instruction from the judge was very specific. In fact, this is another example of where Doug Schmidt did an exceptional job. He researched the law in a way that it hadn't been done before, so that the judge had to give very specific instructions about what premeditation meant in a case like this and malice aforethought, so that the judge gave a lengthy speech on the meaning of these terms. And that meant that they had to match up to this very strict interpretation in order to find Dan White guilty of first degree, and they couldn't. So in fact, the judge's instructions were significant in the verdict they came up with.
What do you think might happen?
Hi, this is Joan Sugar of KPFA's Fruit Punch. If you have any comments about tonight's shows or any shows or how we can help you, the gay community at large, please write us here at KPFA FM 94. The address is 2207 Shattuck Avenue in Berkeley, California. Zip code is 94704. Here comes Soft Cell with Tainted Love.
Clones in love with clones, 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 and clones in love.
comes in love, comes in love with bums, in love with bums, 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 and comes in love.
Be mine.
Bums, bums, and comes in love, comes in love with bums, in love with bums, 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 and comes in love. Bones, bones, and bones, and love, bones, in love with bones, in love with bones, 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 and bones, and love. Bones, bones, and bones, and love, bones, in love with bones, in love with bones, 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 and bones, and love.
Hi, the name of the song is Clones in Love, and it's by two gay men, Michael Biello and Dan Martin. The record's available at Ron's Records, right out of the Castro Street in what we call the Clone Star State, also known as the Penile Colony. And you can get it there every day of the world, so go check it out and support the people that support you. This is dedicated to all the folks who go to gyms. It's by Killer Pussy. It's called Pumparama.
You a story all about my spa, so you better listen or I'm gonna break your jaw. It's a real tough place where everyone's pumping and we all get sweaty and our hearts start pumping and the iron's cracking and the heat gets bumping and in the final workout they all start humping. Hump me in the group, bump me in the gym, hump me in the shower, do it again, brand new dumbbell, hump me when I'm thin, hump me in the spa, we'll go to the gym and swim. Tell you a story all about my spa, so you better listen or I'm gonna break your jaw. It's a real tough place and everyone's pumping and we all get sweaty and our hearts start thumping and the iron's cracking and the beat gets bumping and in the final workout we all start humping and humping and the world will pump me in the gym, hump me in the shower, do it again, brand new with the dumbbell, pump me when I'm thin, hump me in the spa and we'll go to the gym and swim.
Okay, that was Pumparama and this public service announcement. Gay Artists and Writers Collective is a group of published writers, playwrights, recording artists, art directors, cartoonists, etc., who are looking to expand their social and spiritual network. For more information about the group, write John Sugar, that's me, kids, at KPFA-FM. The address is 2207 Shattuck Avenue in Berkeley, California, 94704, or call 415-664-2682. And I have a second public service announcement. A couple of times after I've done Fruit Punch, people have called me, not from the San Francisco or Berkeley area, but small towns, about information about AIDS, that in their towns they simply don't have correct information. So if you want that information, drop me a card here at KPFA and I'll mail it to you if it's that difficult to get. Also, if you're a youth, if you're young and you're in a small town and you feel isolated and you can't find any other gay people, write me care KPFA and I'll Xerox a list of youth groups, etc., that you can get in touch with. I also have a short thing here about safe sex. Safe sex is mutual masturbation. Loving, fighting to make your relationship better, and caring about your sexual partner is the most important thing. You do not need to miss out on a sexual loving relationship because of AIDS. Sexual intensity is a very small part of gay love. You are a very large part of it. And right now, I would like to play, hopefully it's cued, the world's famous drag queen, Charles Pierce.
Are you sure you know where you are, darling? You know I'm a man dressed as a woman for financial purposes only. It's better than my old job. I was a bunny at Rich Street Baths for 4 years. We use scarves in the show, so watch it. That might be whisked right off her neck for, say, an Eleanor Roosevelt. You know, my day is a busy one.
If Charles Pierce has a remaining showbiz itch, it is to become himself one of the great ladies of the silver screen.
Well, I haven't done a big movie. The only movie I ever made was Rabbit Test with
Joan Rivers as director.
Rabbit Test, described by one critic as low-rent Mel Brooks, was a wacky comedy about the world's first pregnant man. Billy Crystal got the big part. Pierce sashayed on in a cameo.
I was the Queen of England. I, Queen of England, and what's left of it, and very happy to be here.
And Billy Crystal, remember he was the pregnant man in that picture.
Looking back on it, Charles Pierce gives Rabbit Test a sleeping man, agreeing with the critics that the film didn't contain enough good gags, or in his case, enough close-ups.
And the scene was so short that my reaction was, oh, gee, you know, I wish it had been a little longer. And so I wasn't that impressed with my look. The scene was shot from a distance, the full length of the Queen. There was no close-up of me with my pocketbook or anything like that, so I was a little disappointed.
What was it like working with Joan Rivers on the film? What was she like as a director?
Well, she was fun, and this was before Joan was really had gotten onto The Tonight Show, but she was still doing very, very well. And she directed me very... It was a cameo, as I said, and the only thing she did... I had the Queen's crown on, slightly tilted, and the first time we met, I was made up in the dress with the crown slightly askew, and she came in and looked at it and said, "You don't build a gag on a gag." And she straightened up the crown.
Pierce is the first to admit that 30 years of hopping in and out of wigs and frocks in nightclubs and on stages around the world has typed him for film and television work.
I know that I painted myself into the corner by working in drag so that the casting people, come to me because they know I'm going to get dressed up, you see. I don't know at this point, unless I did it myself, if I would ever play a male role, a lawyer or a real villain that doesn't get into drag, a doctor, a zany doctor or a zany lawyer. But so far, it's still Charles Pierce, male actress.
It still surprises him that neither he nor any other drag performer has been approached to do a regular TV series.
I'm amazed at, on television, that we don't have on the networks even like a gay female impersonation review. It doesn't even have to be gay, does it? It could just be a female impersonation review.
Charles Pierce has done an uncensored version of his show for the Playboy Channel.
You know, I have done it on television. The Playboy Channel presented my show, videotaped at the Dorothy Chandler Music Center 3 years ago. And that was an hour show, and it showed many, many places on television stations, and a lot of bars around the country picked up on it. I'm known in many gay bars for that particular show.
As a high school student with a good voice, Charles Pierce worked, sans dress, at WWNY, the radio voice of his birthplace, Watertown, New York. The late 40s and early 50s were spent commuting between California's Pasadena Playhouse and New York's Off-Broadway. Beginning his nightclub act in Los Angeles as a stand-up comic in black tux and tie, Charles Pierce started to attract a regular following with his takeoffs on the grand dames of Hollywood. So he decided to dress up the act. The notorious costumes followed.
I did not go to my vocational guidance teacher in high school and say, "I want to be a female impersonator." He came to me, he said, "You know, I've seen you in the halls, Charlie. You're a female impersonator." I'm very masculine. I dress this way to counteract it. I started as a night watchman at Lane Bryant. With lots of time on my hands. Racks of chiffon over there and racks of leather over there. I thought that would turn you on. You know, chiffon and leather, I didn't know what to get into. I was like a bisexual. Which way am I going to turn? I was like a bisexual. I said, "Which way am I going?" I didn't think you heard that.
Charles Pierce appeals to a mixed crowd of gays and straights, often gay men with straight women. He includes his mother among his fans.
My mother has seen the show in New York and out here, and her reaction has always been very favorable. She doesn't like the F word that we use. "Oh, do you have to use that word?" And I'll say, "Yes, I do."
My characters have to use it, Mother.
It wasn't the F word, but the C word that got Charles Pierce into trouble one fine spring night in 1980. Working a double bill at the Castro Theater with the Lesbian Chorus to mark the 74th anniversary of the San Francisco earthquake, Pierce, a.k.a. Betty Davis, launched into that part of his nightclub act where Betty threatens to burn certain vital bodily parts off of Tallulah Bankhead. The joke itself was incendiary. Members of the Lesbian Chorus prepared to walk out on what they felt was a sexist performance, one that was receiving loud hoots of approval and laughter from the mostly male crowd. Charles Pierce then delivered his weather report joke, in which he reverses Bob Dylan's old dictum that you don't need a weatherman to tell which way the wind blows. The political winds that were blowing through the Castro that night turned out to be a forecast of the rather sharp change in relations between men and women in what would soon be called the lesbian gay community. To this day, Charles Pierce says he doesn't know what he did to offend the women.
It's one of those psychological things. It was so horrendous, such a reaction, a tumultuous reaction to my act. I mean, I was doing my nightclub act, as I had been doing for many years, that the group of women would take such offense at it and to it that after it was all over and simmered down, I really have divorced it from my mind. If I was on a psychiatrist's couch, only he could bring that up. My only thought was that I guess I was making, in their minds, everything I said too much fun about women. And they didn't like it, so away they went.
Was that like in some ways a shock for you that times had changed or that there was another audience out there other than the one that you were accustomed to playing to?
Well, I wonder, too, thinking back, if it wasn't like a political setup, because it was a political benefit rally, whatever, and I just wonder if it wasn't thought of in advance, no matter what I would have said, or, you know, they just decided they were going to do it. And it was just an uncomfortable night, that's all.
Because I know since Stonewall in 1969, a lot of gay people, men and women, have reacted against, at least for a time, some of the things that they thought of as stereotypes of gay life. Have you experienced that in any of your audiences?
No, I really haven't, except that one night. But I would react, what's it? Is that the Tin Woodsman chopping down a tree in the background, getting ready for our show? Ah, yes, it is. The little Tin Woodsman sawing away. Now, what were we saying?
We're saying in the last 15 years, have gay people changed in terms of the ones who show up for your shows? Is the taste of the crowd any different than it was prior to 69?
Hard for me to tell because I'm still playing to, quote, fairly full houses. I know the material has changed a little bit, well, quite a lot, and I have tried to do that.
The Charles Pierce Quakes the Castro incident was memorable to two San Francisco novelists who fictionalized it for their own dramatic purposes. Pierce, in these Romana Clef episodes, becomes Chester Gregg in Daniel Curzon's From Violent Men, an angry novel about an imaginary plot to revenge the killing of Harvey Milk. In Dorothy Bryant's A Day in San Francisco, the Pierce character is called Arnold Scott and is the catalyst for a straight woman's decision to leave her husband. The novel's preoccupations concern that woman's problems accepting her gay son at a time right before the outbreak of AIDS. Ironically, Pierce seems to have gotten a new lease on showbiz life following the Castro incident. In November of 1980, Pierce had told the San Francisco Gay Press that he was getting tired of touring and might just put the act on the shelf and move on to other things. Instead, the last 5 years have seen Pierce's popularity grow. Following his third appearance at the Venetian Room, he's now booked for a solid month at the Marines Memorial Theater in San Francisco. And screen fame still beckons. Harvey Fierstein is reportedly considering Pierce for a role in the film version of Torch Song Trilogy. Pierce has even added another character to his old actress pantheon, Joan Collins, impersonating the awesome talents that brought her to Dynasty fame.
And I have to get ready because I'm doing a TNV show, and I have to be Joan Collins, darling. I'm going to be Joan Collins, and Jackie Collins is going to be on the show with me, you see. So I really have to dash away, darling, and fluff up my as I said, my shoes and my wigs and my tits. Why does Betty Davis move her arms like this? Very simple. She's playing with the green giant. Queen Victoria, darling, she was the one that would remain in seclusion, you know, with all the money and the jewels, but dressed in black, so it didn't matter. And she would run out into the daylight hours through the London fog, calling her dog Tiz. Here, Tiz. Here, Tiz. Come and get it! Hey, Abbott! Oh, I'm sorry. That's the wrong impression. I'm sorry. My uvula just took over and left my mind way back in a wig.
And now for a look at Charles Pierce, male actress on stage, here's our critic at large, Daniel Curzon.
What has blonde hair, brunette hair, red hair, two arms, two legs, sounds like a man but dresses like a woman, and is sometimes covered with fur, or to be more precise, furs? That's right, it's called a Charles Pierce. What can be said that hasn't been said already about this male actress who is now, after 30 years in the business, finally attracting mainstream audiences to his lair, where he fiddles with their funny bones and takes liberties with their libidos? The truest thing to say is that Charles Pierce is a professional who knows how to capture the essence of such female luminaries as Joan Collins, Mae West, Katharine Hepburn, and Betty Davis, giving us a shock of recognition, while at the same time giving us the shock of some pretty raw language in the mouths of these great stars. Almost as impressive as the impressions themselves are the quick changes that Mr. Pierce manages to make just by stepping off the stage for a few moments. I laughed 95% of the time at his current intimate extravaganza at the Marines Memorial Theater in San Francisco. If I have any criticisms, they would be about drag shows in general. They strike me as pre-liberated, sort of like minstrel shows about blacks. But one can forgive any form of entertainment if it's well done enough, I suppose. Sometimes I did feel Charles Pierce was a little tired of his show. Perhaps that's because the show I saw was the second show. I hope he'll manage to keep his material fresh for himself without dropping his sharp timing to say or do whatever comes into his head. If you've never seen Pierce's act, you owe it to yourself to go out and have a few laughs. He won't be performing forever, and you will have missed the legend.
Time to build together.
And that's Rochelle Bias, who is a professional singer, but she's really a church singer back in her native Philadelphia. That's where Dan Martin and Michael Biello come from. And she doesn't really want to make a career out of singing, although she sure could. She did it as a favor to Dan and Martin, Michael, to get their record really rolling. And there's another version of that song, which we don't play as often, as a matter of fact, called Male Loving. John Sugar, you've got some... got some dish for us? Got
sure.
some PSAs?
Sure.
What well, you got?
No dish that I can, you know, I can spray over the air right now. But, kids, let me see. On Saturday, November 2nd, on a KPFA show, Women's Magazine, from 12 to 1, there's going to be a special show about women and AIDS. And I'm not making this name up, but this is the woman's name. You ready? Her name is Cherry Pies. I'm not kidding. Cherry Pies. And she's with the Lesbian Insemination Group. And also is Nancy Shaw from the AIDS Foundation. And that's Saturday, November 2nd, and it's a women's magazine. And the show is hosted by my friend Catherine Davenport. So if you're interested in women and AIDS, be sure and check it out. What we plan on doing now is having listener feedback from the show we've done this evening. Whee! I can hear that in here. Is that good? A little twisted radio here, but
you weren't actually supposed to hear that, but oh. but you could hear it legitimately because it was on cue, and it was on program too. That was
there. You go.
My mistake.
That's that good.
Bad. Yes. Bad. To stop that.
That's that good radio wake up stuff. Now what it is we're basically having an open phone forum. But if there are listeners out there that have any insights or comments about tonight's program, if there's anything they want to say about Dan White that hasn't been said, or if they, you know, want to make a personal statement about how they feel about Dan White's suicide, the number is 848-4425.
Or, let's see. Here we go. Turn on the Fruit Punch Singers.
Shoo-bop, Fruit Punch.
You're tuned to J-Man's Radio. We'd like to hear your thoughts, discuss reviews. So if you're listening, please give a little ring. Don't be shy.
There's the number, won't you pick up your phone and dial.
Call. In Berkeley, the number is 848-4425. 848-4425.
Don't be shy.
Here's the number, won't you pick up your phone and dial.
Oh, and they're letting up, as they say. And let's go to the board right now. You're on Fruit Punch. What do you want to say about Dan White?
I thought one of the more interesting headlines was one that you omitted in your program this evening, was he came home to die. And that was in the Examiner. And it seemed to me that they were equating it to coming home to die of cancer or something.
Huh.
Sort of a biological phenomenon.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you very much for your comment. We're going to get the other calls.
Thank you.
Hi, you're on KPFA. Go ahead. This is KPFA, and you can call us here at 848-4425.
You're on the air right now. Go ahead.
We're going to get more calls.
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, I got a couple comments about Dan White. I think... people have been saying this is the last chapter of the story, but I think the damage he did to San Francisco politics is still going on. And I think the reign of Ms. Feinstein's been really disastrous. The coalitions that Harvey Milk were trying to forge between the gay community and the minority communities have been totally disrupted. And it seems like, well, I'm not gay, but from what I've seen, it seems like the gay community is more divided now than it's ever been. And I think one of the things you should keep in mind when you talk about the assassination of Moscone and Milk is, I know a lot of times this has been kind of fobbed off as a coincidence or something, but that Jonestown had happened just a couple of days before. And I don't know what the connection could be if somehow they'd brainwashed Dan White into doing those assassinations or what.
Bye-bye.
Actually, he was a housing official for George Moscone.
Oh, I'm sorry, housing official. I thought he said he was right. In Feinstein's administration.
No, he was in George Moscone's administration. As a matter of fact, one of the things that Warren Hinkle talks about was precisely whether George Moscone's election was contaminated in some ways by People's Temple. You're on the radio with Fruit Punch. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I just thought when he moved
back to San Francisco, I said to myself, this guy's suicidal.
Well, thank you. I think that's a B-flat. Huh?
And we can take some more calls at 848-4425. That was one of the things that people in 1978 were wondering about, because Jones had been part of George Moscone's administration, and there were a lot of rumors about whether or not there was some kind of a conspiracy, a hit list or something like that. You're on the radio with John Sugar and David Lamble on Fruit Punch. Go ahead.
Good evening, David Lamble.
Good evening.
I didn't call up to talk about Dan White this evening because I think enough has already been said about the subject, and I think everything should rest in peace. What I called up to talk about is I've heard a rumor going around the community that Fruit Punch plans to do a soap opera drama. Now, this really excites me, and is this true, David? Is this true?
A soap opera? Well, KFRC is going to game shows. I guess Fruit Punch will become all soap opera sometime in the future.
So you are substantiating that rumor, is that correct?
That's a rumor, right. That's a rumor. But we'll see if some good writing can substantiate that rumor, perhaps.
Okay, great. Well, I eagerly look forward to it.
Okay.
Good night.
Coming attractions on KPFA. You're on the radio. Go ahead.
Yes, I just called up to disagree with Daniel Curzon's comments.
Well, you're the best one to do it.
You're never alone in a split-level head.
Good show.
Well, thank you, Mr. Brown.
Thank you.
848-4425 is the number. 848-4425.
And we'd like to take all kinds of comments about the Dan White case. What do you think of the media coverage, as a matter of fact? The Examiner, this is one of those stories that the Examiner and Chronicle sort of have on the shelf, and it's one of the stories they give the most thorough attention to, and they really do a fairly decent job with it, unlike many things in the news. You're on the radio with David Lamble, John Sugar, and Fruit Punch. Speak your mind.
Yeah, you had a great show tonight.
Thank you.
I enjoyed it. And you need a compliment on your traffic cam interview this afternoon, too.
Oh,
I thought it was very well done.
Oh, Juan Jacobo Hernandez. Yes, catch his show at the Valencia Rose. He'll couple weekends.
Thanks a million.
Thank you. You're on with John Sugar and David Lamble. Go ahead on Fruit Punch.
Hi. Since I tuned in late, I don't know if you mentioned that there is going to be an AIDS vigil Sunday night.
No, we didn't. I'm not sure if we did.
Oh, my gosh. And it's starting off with entertainment, too. Judy Fiala, an unknown special guest from out of town, will be singing at the beginning of the vigil, between 7:30 and 8:30, and various people will be speaking.
Okay, where's it going to be, Civic Center?
It's going to be at almost Civic Center, United Nations Plaza,
okay,
from the Health and Human Services Building, all night long, and there'll be a rally at noon on Monday in support of people who will be possibly picketing or doing something else at the White House at that time.
Okay, very good, and thank you for bringing that up for us.
Bye-bye now.
Bye.
Okay, 848-4425. Any comments you would like on the day's news, especially the Dan White news as it's come down this particular week? And Fruit Punch, by the way, I think the Fruit Punch Collective will be repeating the documentary in November, the Harvey Milk Dan White documentary, with some updated material to take in what seems to be the end of the story, actually. After 7 years, it seems like we finally have a wrap on this one. And we'll do that probably the last 2 weeks in November.
At a recent Dan White potluck I attended, it was a sober event that I organized to join with gay fellows about the demise of Mr. White. One friend of mine commented that had he killed himself in November or October of 1978, we could have all saved ourselves a lot of misery.
It changed the world in a lot of ways. It helped bring a lot of people to San Francisco, as a matter of fact. Some personal friends of mine, and indirectly myself, came here in part as a result of the aftermath of the death of Harvey Milk.
It really was the beginning of the end. I mean, shortly after, when Moscone and Milk left, we got a more to the middle kind of conservative city government, including a Dianne Feinstein mayor who was much more supportive of things like the Vice Squad, where former Mayor Moscone, who the media doesn't talk about this, but it's known that he favored black prostitutes, for example, and he didn't pressure gay establishments, he didn't raid with the ferocity that Feinstein does, and I know these things for a fact because right after she took office, I was arrested for running a house of prostitution.
That's right. That's the first conversation we had on the radio on KGOFM, John Sugar, was your bust as an adult bookstore manager. Yeah.
This is true. Any comments? We have we've decided to have an open phone forum tonight, so if you're sitting at home and if you have something you'd like to say to the gay community at large, this is KPFA's Fruit Punch, a gay radio show that airs every single Wednesday night at 10 p.m., and you can call us here at 848-4425. That's 848-4425.
And there's gay programming as you drive home Wednesdays from 4:30 to 6 on Traffic Jam, and so do give us a listen then, too. And in upcoming shows on Traffic Jam, we're going to have Anne Rice, author of Lestat the Vampire, the sequel to Interview with the Vampire. Final call tonight. Go ahead. You're on Fruit Punch.
My name's John. I used to be a street musician. And right after Feinstein took office, a lot of friends of mine who were supporting themselves, making money playing music on the streets, just had to leave town. You know, they were supporting themselves. She put an almost end to street music, most of the street music in the city. I just thought I'd throw that on. She doesn't like anything except money.
Good point. Okay. Well, that's an appropriate point to get to the last record tonight. That's it, Fruit Punch. John Sugar, last comment.
I would like to say if there are any letters of support, we sure could use them to show the management that you people care. We know you do because during the marathon we raised a lot of money on our gay radio programming. But please send us fan mail and all kinds of things to KPFA, care of Fruit Punch. You can put my name or David Lample's on it, 2207 Shattuck Avenue, Berkeley, California.
And Fruit Punch, soon to be in the street. That's a Fruit Punch of a Wednesday evening. Listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio for Northern California and the Central Valley. KPFA, KPFB, Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, FM 94 Villa Grande. It's 11:01 and time for a rebroadcast of the KPFA Evening News.
Good evening. It's Wednesday, October 23rd. The Senate Judiciary Committee takes up another controversial nomination for the number two position at the Justice Department. President Reagan's last appointment to the post was rejected for not being totally forthcoming with the committee.